is live in the studios once again. John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our new KEXP music program has slightly rewritten show tunes.
We won't be going into that.
No, let's not. All right. Starting things out with local and a settlement with the John T. Williams case.
Yes. The family of John T. Williams, a Native American woodcarver who was shot by a Seattle police officer last August, had brought a lawsuit against the city of Seattle. Well, this week, the city settled that lawsuit for $1.5 million. This was a result of mediation between the Williams family and the city. This is at the same time that the U.S. Department of Justice is reviewing the facts in the Williams case for potential civil rights violations. So you can see how the city settling the lawsuit as quickly as possible might have some, I would guess they're hoping it would have some bearing in that investigation by the Department of Justice. Of course, the Department of Justice is also investigating the entire Seattle Police Department for a whole bunch of different cases of
at least a half dozen that they're looking at.
Yeah, of potential police abuse against suspects, people being kicked, punched, spat on, you know, racial slurs thrown around, that sort of thing. So, this settlement was, I'm sure, in order to avoid a trial again, going over those same facts in the John T. Williams case.
Yeah, particularly since in the fact-finding inquest, the officer, Ian Burke, did not exactly cover himself with glory in his testimony, and the city would probably like to avoid that spectacle happening again.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else on that?
No.
Okay, let's move on. There was a assault case thrown out this week.
Oh, yeah, in King County Superior Court. Another criminal case thrown out of court. It was a Seattle Police Department lawsuit against a man arrested last April for assaulting Officer Shandy Cobain. If I remember correctly, Shandy Cobain was the officer involved in the unfortunate incident where he stomped on and uttered a racial slur against a Latino suspect the man was not arrested in that case.
He turned out to be the wrong suspect.
Yeah, he turned out to be the wrong guy, but it was caught on camera, and that incident is forming part of why the Department of Justice is undergoing its investigation against the SPD. Well, in court this week, the King County Superior Court Judge Joan DeBook threw out the case last April, where Shandy Cobain involved in the arrest of some suspects in a bar fight was claimed to have been assaulted by one of those suspects. She cited the case as the most poorly investigated case she'd ever seen. There was a lack of officer and witness statements, and she said that all units at the scene had completely failed to activate their dashboard cameras, which is supposed to be a Seattle Police Department policy, that they activate their dashboard cameras every time.
Is that a coincidence that none of them were activated?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering.
I think that's what she was saying in a roundabout kind of way, that the fact that not a single one of them was activated was highly suspicious to her. And I just want to take a minute to point out, too, that the dashboard cameras are not something that was the idea of the Seattle Police Department originally. It was something that the police department came up with as a way to appease activists who were angry over, you know, a long period of violations by the Seattle Police Department against particularly ethnic minority suspects.
I would also take us back to the state of my head of the Seattle Police Officers Guild after, I believe it was the Cobain incident in Belltown involving the videotaping of the racial slur. Maybe it was the jaywalking outside Rainier Avenue. They all tend to blur together after a while. But in any event, his advice to police officers didn't have anything to do with amending their behavior, except in the case of being aware of where the cameras are before you do anything.
Before you punch people.
Exactly. So it sounds like they were taking his advice to heart and being aware of where the cameras are and somebody making sure not to turn them on.
Moving on, the Seattle Center looks like it has a new tenant.
It will have a new tenant. Yes, the Seattle City Council this week chose the Dale Chihuly exhibit as the winner for the new space at the Seattle Center, where the Fun Forest will be, well, where the Fun Forest used to be. They're closing that down. They're going to put up some new things, and they decided this week it was going to be the new church of Dale Chihuly. It's called a glass exhibition hall, but I want to note that Nick Licata, one of the city council members, had to specifically request that the council remove a non-compete clause that would have prohibited all other glass artists from exhibiting works anywhere on the Seattle Center grounds. You have to be asking, where the heck did that non-compete clause come from?
Yeah, particularly since that is, last I checked, public land.
Yeah, and as it is, the new exhibit hall will be devoted entirely to one artist, and any other glass artist or artist of any other kind who wants to exhibit on the Seattle Center grounds is going to have to wait until the Center House opens its own and probably very much smaller gallery space. And I'm guessing it's probably going to be tucked upstairs in the Center House where very few people go.
I don't think it's actually accurate to say that the Chihuly Museum is only going to feature one artist. Because after all, the Chihuly has dozens of people working there that actually do most of the work.
Yes, we should point out, too, that Dale Chihuly's reputation as an artist is built on the work of his many, many assistants.
Yeah. By the way, also, KEXP also is having some of that sales center space for its new studio. So so there is some good that comes out of the overall plan, but the Chihuly Museum itself and the very stacked process that led to the decision to pick that museum as the use of the space to replace the Fun Forest. Very, very questionable use of public space.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, that they picked the most commercial option. And they also, you know, I looked at that and I thought, you know, Chihuly already has a big exhibit down in Tacoma. You know, this is very clearly an attempt by the city of Seattle to keep people from going down to Tacoma to visit the Glass Museum down there.
Although the Glass Museum down there does have other artists.
Yeah, and it's got the Hot Shop. It's a wonderful place to visit. And this exhibit at the Seattle Center is in no way going to replace that. I don't think it's even going to come close to that as a great, you know, space to view art.
All right. Moving on, the city council made some zoning changes in the International District.
Yeah, the city council approved the zoning changes for the ID and Soto this week. In Chinatown, 8 stories was the limit, and now it's going to go up to 15. In the area east of Pioneer Square, it will go from 15 stories up to 24 stories. But I found it interesting that the council then said that they were setting aside certain main corridors in Pioneer Square and Chinatown that would not be part of this upzoning, which is almost an admission that, yes, when we allow taller buildings, they really are an eyesore. I found that kind of interesting. But it also brings into the question, too, much of Pioneer Square, the International District, Chinatown, et cetera, is on fill. So is it really safe to be buildings that tall in an area that's particularly vulnerable in an earthquake?
Yeah, and there's also the question that Pioneer Square itself, of course, is a historic district. So the area in the immediate heart of Pioneer Square, they can't raise the building roofs on that, but it's very much going to detract from the ambiance of Pioneer Square to have these towering skyscrapers immediately adjacent to them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you can block those buildings from the main corridor, but when they're half a block or a block back, that's not going to protect the historic character of the entire neighborhood very much.
No, and you can see that in other cities, places like New York City, where you can have, you know, an old, you know, 18th century church and, you know, this huge glass tower right behind it. Well, it doesn't really give you that much of an ambiance of a historic. It just means, well, something sure prevented that site from being developed.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on. Updates this week regarding medical marijuana.
Yeah, we're back on the topic of glass art. think about it. Governor Greg Warren yesterday at the Friday afternoon news dump, the topic popularized by George W. Bush. Well, now our very own governor is engaging, you know, waiting until the slowest portion of the news week to veto most of the medical marijuana dispensary bill that torturously made its way through the legislature this year. basically, she vetoed all parts of it except for the patient registry, which actually is worse than having vetoed all of it, because there's really very little of the original bill that's left in the way of patient protection to protect medical marijuana patients from being either discriminated against or arrested by law enforcement. But now you're asking medical marijuana patients to give the government a list of who the patients are. You're probably going to see a very high rate of noncompliance with the list because, just because you're on medical marijuana doesn't mean you shouldn't be paranoid.
And I find it interesting that her justification for vetoing the bill, the fact that she couldn't ask state employees to risk risk the federal arrest by permitting and investigate, by permitting and approving these medical marijuana dispensaries. I found that to be pretty bad because the state law says that medical marijuana patients shouldn't be discriminated against in housing or health care. Well, doesn't that put doctors and landlords at the same risk that state employees would be if they licensed and permitted and inspected medical marijuana dispensaries? It just seems pretty two-faced to me to say, I'm vetoing this bill because it puts state workers at special risk. Well, it really doesn't, not any more than it does, say, for example, the landlord of someone who is a medical marijuana patient.
It wouldn't have put any of them at risk.
Exactly.
In fact, there are already six states with very similar dispensary bills on the books. The federal government has not made any kind of attempt or even come close to making any kind of attempts to interfere with the dispensary system in any of those states. And, the whole prospect of the federal government interfering in Washington State is something that was very carefully orchestrated by Greg Warr just in the last week or two before her veto of the bill. You had the opinions from the U.S. Attorneys of Eastern and Western Washington, which Greg Warr requested, saying that they would look at this. You had the very conveniently timed raid on Thursday on dispensaries in Spokane, which was the first time that had happened. It seems like Greg Warr called in a few favors. Of course, being the former state attorney general in Washington State, it's very much the same community of people. And, she basically was using this as an elaborate justification for something she already wanted to do for her own reasons, either because she was tight with law enforcement, because she's angling for an appointment in the second term of the Obama administration, for some reason or another, but it certainly doesn't have anything to do with either the merits of the bill or the health and safety of the state's medical marijuana patients.
Exactly.
All right. Let's move on. Local controversy over some billboards.
Yeah, and people have heard about that already for some of the folks who are tuning in at 7:30. A group in Seattle that advocates for Palestinian rights had tried last winter to rent bus boards advocating for Palestinian rights. That was refused by King County Metro. So instead, they went and rented some billboards this past week. Several of them did, in fact, get up on LA Avenue West and on Aurora Avenue, east of Queen Anne Hill and a couple of other places, but they were abruptly taken down this week by Clear Channel, the billboard and media company that owns the billboards, because of what Clear Channel called complaints by advocacy groups. Now, that you can read that to mean pro-Israeli government groups, AIPAC and those types of groups, obviously complained and complained loudly. What's particularly interesting about this is that there are a number of other public policy advocacy billboards that Clear Channel seems to have no compunction about running. For example, there are billboards all over the city that target pregnant women and urging them not to have abortions. That doesn't seem to be controversial, but billboards that state equal rights for Palestinians, that seems to be too controversial for Clear Channel to handle. And it raises the question once again of when you have such consolidated media control of billboards, of television and radio companies, of networks, and so forth, how difficult it is to have an honest debate about a policy issue like this when it's subject to such heavy-handed censorship.
Moving on to national and starting with Guantanamo files made public this week.
Yeah, everyone's probably heard about the WikiLeaks documents that were actually leaked not through the WikiLeaks website, but someone from WikiLeaks had made them available to the New York Times and a couple of other media outlets I'm guessing probably because they didn't like the fact that they weren't being released in a quick enough way. They were the assessments.
They were leaked from WikiLeaks.
They were leaked from WikiLeaks, which I find to be very interesting and kind of a fun topic in itself. But they were assessments of detainees at Guantanamo. And the assessments from looking at them, you can see that they relied almost exclusively on testimonies of other detainees, often obtained under torture or in exchange for better treatment. Often the only witnesses against a detainee were men who were mentally ill or known to be unreliable. That is, that they often lied in order to get favors from their jailers. Some detainees' confessions contained in the documents were later withdrawn and attributed to torture or abuse, but that wasn't noted in the assessments themselves. For example, Abu Zubaydah, who's been the subject of the worst tortures there at Guantanamo, including waterboarding, is quoted in more than 100 of the assessments, and no mention is made in any of the assessments that the information was probably obtained through his torture. Most of this stuff, it's very clear from looking at the assessments, that most of this stuff would never hold up in any court, whether it be a civilian court or a military court. And the worst thing about all this is that while these documents are now a public record and anyone can log on to the internet and see them, the defense attorneys for the Guantanamo detainees cannot read them and cannot use them in defense of their own clients. Those attorneys are bound by their security clearances, and the government has refused to allow them to view these documents except in a secured facility. So if they go online and look at them, then they may be disqualified from representing their own clients.
Yeah, I mean, the phrase for this sort of operation is kangaroo court.
Exactly.
Wow. All right, moving on. Developments this week regarding stem cells.
Yeah, good court outcome this week. The D.C. Federal Appeals Court ruling that embryonic stem cell research can continue. It had been put on hold after a lower court had ruled earlier this year that not just the limited stem cell research of existing lines that was approved by George W. Bush, and then the wider use that was approved by President Obama when he came into office, that all of that, including the Bush-approved limited use, was illegal. So the Obama administration had been forced to shut down all stem cell research. Mind you, this is the type of debate that simply is not happening in other parts of the world. You know, Europe and China and Japan and so forth, they're all going ahead with medical research. They're going ahead with the cutting-edge scientific advances that in the United States we are so often prescribed from doing because of people's religious beliefs. At the same time, the fact that the Federal Appeals Court did rule in this case underscores that as frustrating as the Obama administration has been on a number of issues, there are significant differences between how the Republicans would rule and how Democrats are ruling. If the Republicans had been ruling, the federal government never would have appealed that lower court decision in the first place, and Republicans probably wouldn't be advocating to ban all scientific research on the grounds that, well, you know, it's knowledge.
Actually, I think in the EU, there was a judge that ruled this week that against the patenting of anything coming out of stem cells that the British researchers.
But that's a very different issue having to do with the patenting of life forms.
Yeah, and that is a very important issue in itself.
Being able to make money off them.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on then, that takes us into international, starting with Yemen.
Yeah, this week in Yemen, the dictator.
Very long movie.
What's that?
Yemen.
Yeah.
I miss that.
In Yemen, the dictator Ali Abdullah Saleh agreed to step down in about 30 days in exchange for immunity from prosecution for him and his very large extended family, who have all been running the country for the last 32 years. The deal was brokered by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Cooperation Council, which everyone generally knows is run by Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is worried about unrest in countries that border its own territories. What I find very interesting about this whole, this much-hailed agreement is that it was brokered with a Yemeni opposition that clearly doesn't represent the protesters in the streets. When the protests began in Yemen, the official Yemeni opposition was against the protests. because they've always had a very buddy-buddy relationship with Saleh and his extended family. However, now, but once the protests started to take off and really gain steam, then the Yemeni opposition finally got on board, and now they're trying to get ahead of the Vanguard and make this deal with the dictator. But I'm guessing it's not going to stop the street demonstrations.
Yeah. All right. Bahrain.
In Bahrain, Saudi Arabia has its fingers in another pie in Bahrain. If you remember last month, about 1,500 troops from Saudi Arabia invaded Bahrain in order to help them, quote-unquote, secure their borders and to free up the Bahrain military and police to crack down on demonstrators there. The Bahrain government is now reported to be, and you won't find this anywhere in mainstream U.S. media. I had to read this in the Enterprise Wire Service. The Bahrain government is engaged in mass secret arrests of teachers, doctors, lawyers, journalists, college professors, union leaders, and other intellectuals. Over 500 people have been arrested, and scores have simply disappeared, many of those people being arrested in the middle of the night, and their families have no idea where they're being held or where they've gone. There have been a mass firing of over 1,200 people from government jobs. And people who were mostly fired because they were seen as having participated in demonstrations against the government. And the government has set up a new court to try, quote-unquote, enemies of the state. And I just want to point out that Bahrain is our good ally in the region, and it's where the U.S. 5th Naval Fleet is based. We have a lot of, the U.S. government has a lot of influence on what happens in Bahrain, and they're not using any of that influence to try to stop this mass repression.
I'd actually go a step beyond that and say that those sorts of activities are likely not happening without at least active U.S. knowledge, if not complicity.
Yeah.
All right. That takes us on then to Egypt.
Oh, yeah, and I want to point out that while Saudi Arabia is helping to spread the dictatorship around the Middle East, Egypt is serving as a counterweight to Saudi Arabia and the U.S. influence in the region. They announced in Cairo this week that they had broken a deal for the two rival factions of the Palestinian government, Fatah and Hamas, a step towards creating a unity government in the Palestinian territories, a very promising sign. They also announced this week that they will normalize, that the Egyptian government will normalize relations with Iran, as they pointed out to U.S. reporters. Well, everyone else in the world except for U.S. and Israel has normal relations with Iran. We would like to have those too. They also announced that they were considering opening the border between the Sinai and the Gaza Strip, thereby ending the Israeli blockade, the U.S.-Israeli blockade of the Gaza Strip, which would be a very big deal if they actually do it.
Yeah, and going back again to the oil controversy over the Palestinian rights billboards, it is so difficult to find objective coverage of anything that has to do with Israel and Palestine in this country that the coverage of the deal between Hamas and Fatah, again, was very, very deeply flawed. New York Times, for example, quoting that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has warned that reconciliation between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas could spell the end of the peace process. Well, there's a couple problems with that. Number one, that was the second one I was going to say, that there is no peace process. But beyond that, Hamas is the government of the Palestinian Authority. Fatah is not the Palestinian Authority. They control the West Bank. It's backwards.
Yeah,
but it confers legitimacy on Fatah that does not actually exist.
Yeah.
Fatah actually split from Hamas with the covert backing of the United States and Israel after Hamas was legitimately elected by the Palestinian people in 2006.
That's another case of what happened in the Ivory Coast. Hamas won the parliamentary elections in 2006, and Fatah refused to give up power.
Yeah,
is exactly what happened.
Exactly, except in this case, the international community, led by the United States and of course Israel, supported the wrong side.
Yeah,
absolutely correct.
All right. Uganda.
Yeah. Yeah, while Arab countries in the Middle East and kind of the Gulf states and Syria and Libya and so forth are getting a lot of attention, Sub-Saharan Africa has also been the scene of a number of countries over the past couple of months that have seen pro-democracy and anti-dictatorship protests. It blew up today, this week rather, in Uganda as well. Riots in Kampala after opposition leader Kizza Besigye was arrested for the fourth time in April. You had police firing live rounds at unarmed protesters this following 2 weeks of unrest triggered by rising food and fuel prices. This is something we're going to be hearing a lot more about, particularly in poorer countries around the world where people who are living literally subsistence incomes are simply not able to afford the largely commodity-driven spike in food and fuel and subsequently food prices. We saw this in 2008. We're going to see another round of it again this year. The government in Uganda trying unsuccessfully to block Facebook and Twitter. In other words, all the hallmarks that caught the world's attention when they happened in the Middle East and in North Africa, but because it's happening in Sub-Saharan Africa, nobody's paying attention.
Interesting that the electronic mediums people are using, Facebook and Twitter, are again, I mean, I remember.
Yeah, even in the poorest countries in the world, that's become a major issue.
All right. Events.
Yeah, a couple of events coming up. Tomorrow is May Day, and in Seattle, as with many parts of the country, that has come to mean an immigrant march and rally for the 11th year in a row. It'll be happening this year. It actually looks like it'll be larger this year than it's been in some recent years. Noon at Judkins Playfield behind St. Mary's Church at 611 20th Avenue South will be the massive immigrant march and rally. The immigrant rights march and rally that will be happening tomorrow. And then later this week, Friday and Saturday, May 6th through 7th, I am my brother's keeper, a conference on confronting Islamophobia with a number of very good speakers. Looks like it'll be happening. That'll be at St. Mark's Cathedral on Capitol Hill at 1245 10th Avenue East. And if you'd like to find out more about that conference, the website with all the speakers and the program is at www.confrontingislamophobia.org.
Well, we still have a couple minutes left there.
We may have to go back to those musicals.
Well, we can talk a little bit about a major prison break in Afghanistan.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah, where about 500 different fighters were broken out of a major prison in Afghanistan, the Sarposa prison. This is not the first time there's been a prison break at that prison. There was one, I think, a little over a year ago. It was done in a very different way. A tunnel was dug, a very elaborate tunnel that had electricity hooked up inside of it and also had an elaborate ventilation system. It was planned so well that the majority of, nearly all of the Taliban fighters who were held in that prison, including two shadow governors of provinces in Afghanistan, were broken out of the prison. They broke out of the prison by escaping through that tunnel. But they also dug a little side tunnel. They also dug a little side tunnel over to the criminal side of the prison, and a number of the criminal detainees in the prison broke out as well. And so this is something that the Afghan government has called a major disaster. And I think that would be an understatement, the fact that some very hardcore Taliban commanders and fighters have escaped from prison in order to bolster the Taliban. I would call that evidence that we're fighting a war that is not winnable in Afghanistan.
And it's also very clear that that prison break could not have happened without inside help, that there were people infiltrating the prison establishment also who helped that prison break happen.
Yeah. And you know, we almost never hear Afghanistan discussed in these terms here in this country. But, you know, the Taliban are indigenous to Afghanistan. And we are supporting a government of returned exiles who do not have a political base in Afghanistan. The Taliban do. And the fact that we're there fighting the indigenous population should remind us of another war that we lost many years ago.
Three or four of them.
Yes.
And as well, I think this is the news of this tunnel has sprung up a third initiative challenging the local Deepwater tunnel, that if it is in fact built, that this group come in and do the actual building of the tunnel, since they were so successful.
It's a good job.
They did a much better job of it, you know, less risk, and yeah, it's
and compliant
possibilities.
Yeah, with
and on budget.
So, talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. Writes about the tunnel and various other local, national, international news and events and comics and so forth. So check it out.